Chapter 10, Buddhism and Christianity. For the last 9 months, I have spent much of my time thinking and writing about the contact I have had with Christianity and Christians in the course of the last 80 years. This is the longest time I have ever spent immersed in the religion into which I was born, or at least baptized, and to which I never really belonged. And those who have followed me thus far may want to know what I have learnt from the experience. Have I changed my ideas about Christianity, or about Buddhism, or about the relation between the two religions? Have I learnt anything about myself? I do not think I have learnt from my immersion in Christianity anything that I did not know before, but it certainly helped me to see more clearly and feel more deeply some of the things I already knew, and for this reason I believe the experience to have been worthwhile. Though I was not in a position to embark on a systematic comparative study of Buddhism and Christianity, which in any case would have been an immense undertaking, such limited comparisons as I was able to make were sufficient to highlight the fundamental differences that exist between the two religions. The fact that there are such differences, not only between Buddhism and Christianity, but also between them and other religions, and between the other religions themselves, at once gives rise to certain questions. How, for instance, can people of different religious beliefs live together in peace and harmony, or at least without overt conflict? One answer is that this happy state of affairs would be achieved if everybody were to believe that religions were in essence the same, or that they all lead ultimately to the same goal. Neither Orthodox Buddhists nor Orthodox Christians would agree that religions are in fact the same in essence, or that they all lead ultimately to the same goal. And this has been my position too, ever since I started thinking seriously about the Buddha's teaching. But at this point, Buddhists and Christians part company. According to Buddhism, it is possible for one to be convinced of the truth of one's own faith, and yet at the same time to feel no hatred for those who think differently. Indeed, for one who is a Buddhist, it is desirable, even imperative, that he should have towards those of other faiths an attitude not of hatred, but of positive goodwill. For hatred is an obstacle on the path to enlightenment, besides being disruptive of that sense of natural solidarity with other human beings on which ethics is based. Judging by the way the Church has treated heretics and non-believers when it was in a position of power, Christians believe that conviction of the truth of one's own faith is not incompatible with hatred for those who think differently. Indeed, many Christians seem to have believed that it was good and right and pleasing to God that they should, as a natural expression of their faith, hate and persecute pagans and heretics. I have always been aware of the Christian record in this respect, but as a result of my recent immersion in Christianity, especially in its Roman Catholic form, I have become more aware of what that record tells us about the nature of Christianity. Like most other people, I tended to regard such phenomena as the Inquisition and the Crusades as unfortunate episodes in European history, regrettable mainly on account of the tens of thousands of human lives they had brought to an untimely end. The officers of the Inquisition, in conjunction with the secular authorities, sent men and women to the stake because they refused to believe as the Church believed. The Crusaders slew Muslims because they were followers of a different religion. As I reflected on these things, I felt more deeply than ever the enormity of religious intolerance, springing as it does from an unholy alliance of ignorance, hatred, and fear. I thought of the lonely death of the Bohemian reformer Jan Hus, sent to the stake by the Council of Constance in 1415 as a heretic for attacking the ecclesiastical abuses and rejecting the Pope's authority. I recalled seeing in the Prado Berruguet's famous painting of Saint Dominic presiding over the burning of heretics, in the bottom right-hand corner of which Two naked, anonymous victims of the Inquisition are seen fastened to posts, ready for burning, while Saint Dominic, seated aloft beneath a huge canopy, his throne surrounded by clerical and lay dignitaries, calmly presides over the proceedings. I also bethought me of the 200 and more perfecti, who, after the surrender of the great Cathar fortress of Montségur in 1244, were thrust into a wooded palisade with combustible material and burnt. Jan Hus, the anonymous victims of the Inquisition, and the 200 or more Cathar perfecti, as well as tens of thousands of other heretics, were all burnt alive. Emphasis on burnt alive. Thus suffering one of the most horrible of deaths. These burnings took place under the auspices of the highest religious and secular authorities. They were justified by theologians, approved by saints and mystics, and applauded by ordinary people. Apologists for Christianity have naturally sought to minimize the significance of the burnings, arguing that the number of victims has been exaggerated, or that Christianity has done more good in the world than harm, or that what men did in the Middle Ages is not to be judged by modern standards. I find none of these arguments convincing. Nothing can minimize the horror of a man or woman being burnt alive for believing differently from the rest of the community. It was not that the officers of the Inquisition, for example, necessarily enjoyed their work, or that they became inquisitors because it put them in the position of being able to inflict pain and suffering on others. For the most part, they seem to have been learned and pious men who were determined to stamp out heresy and who believed that in burning heretics they were doing their duty by God and man. If they ever felt pity for the sufferings of their victims, they would probably have stifled the feeling, regarding it as being inspired by the devil. There would seem to be in the very nature of Christianity a strand of intolerance that is capable of overriding all considerations of common humanity. In the course of recent months, I have become more aware of this deadly strand, and more aware of the difference in this and other respects between Buddhism and Christianity. Though I have spoken of my being immersed in Christianity, I have in fact often been immersed in Roman Catholicism, this being the form of Christianity that has played a dominant part in the political and economic life of Western Europe, as well as in its religious and cultural life. It's no accident that Roman Catholicism is so called. It is the Roman Catholic Church itself that is the true legatee of the Roman Empire, not the so-called Holy Roman Empire, for it was the Roman Church which, for 1,000 years, from the sack of Rome by the Goths to the Reformation, provided the iron framework that helped to hold the peoples of Western Europe together as the religio-political entity known as Christendom, of which the Pope was the supreme head and ultimate authority. This iron framework prevented Western Europe from falling into chaos, and to this extent it was a good thing, as I saw more clearly as I renewed my acquaintance with the history of Western Europe during the period of papal ascendancy. But although that iron framework helped to ensure a degree of social and political stability and cohesion, intellectually and spiritually it was often constrictive, and to this extent it was a bad thing. At its most constrictive, intellectually and spiritually speaking, it could be destructive not only of independent thought, but of life, as in its treatment of heresy and heretics. In every generation there were, however, men and women who, while the rest were content to live out their lives within the framework, contrived to find or make little openings in it through which they could get a glimpse of the wider world outside. There were others who made use of it for their own purposes, whether noble or ignoble, creative or exploitative. Among these were the poets and artists, especially the artists. The framework consisted not only of dogmas and laws, myths, symbols, and sacred history were also part of it. Provided he respected certain conventions, the artist was free to depict a subject taken from the Bible or the legends of the saints, or ecclesiastical history, in accordance with the dictates of his own genius. If he painted a picture of Saint Jerome in his study, for example, he would almost certainly have included the saint's broad-brimmed cardinal's hat, and the hat would have been red, not any other colour. But such details as the dimension of the study, the nature of its furniture, how it was lighted, and whether or not Saint Jerome was half-naked or had a long white beard, were all left to the discretion and taste of the artist, unless the individual or community commissioning the painting had some wishes in this connection, in which case he would have respected them, just as he respected the conventions laid down by the church. Altogether, there must be scores, even hundreds, of such paintings of Saint Jerome, all making use of at least some of the traditional iconographic elements, but all differing in style and treatment. From the best of these, we learn less about Saint Jerome than about the character, temperament, and depth of insight of the artist himself. A painting of Saint Jerome in his study may not be so much a Christian work of art as a manifestation of human creativity, as may a painting of a subject taken from the Bible, or the lives of the saints, or ecclesiastical tradition. This is why I am able, though a Buddhist, to appreciate and enjoy, even to be deeply moved by, what is best and greatest in Christian art, as well as what is best and greatest in Christian poetry and music. In this I am not alone among Western Buddhists, some of whom would say that it was only after becoming Buddhists that they learned to appreciate Christian art. A Christian painting contains no overt doctrinal elements, which would be repugnant to me. For viewed simply as a painting, it does not contain, and cannot contain, any conceptual element. On the other hand, a Christian musical composition, such as Bach's Mass in B minor or Handel's Messiah, does contain a doctrinal element, inasmuch as it is a setting to music of the words of a certain religious text. In which case, I can either ignore the words, this is easier if they are in a language I do not understand, or mentally give them a Buddhist application. A Christian poem consists of words, as does any poem, and some of these words will be expressive of concepts, including doctrinal concepts. If the poem happens to be a narrative one, like Paradise Lost or the Divine Comedy, the doctrinal concepts will be part of the story, like Homer's assertions about his gods and goddesses in the Iliad and the Odyssey, and their presence therefore does not obstruct my enjoyment of the poem. It is because I distinguish between Christianity and Christian culture, and see the latter as owing far more to human genius than to the teaching of the church, that I am able, though a Buddhist, to appreciate and enjoy the Christian art, music, and poetry of the West. I am thus in a paradoxical position. As a Buddhist, I reject Christian doctrine, but as a Westerner, I am able to appreciate and enjoy Christian culture. But I am a Western Buddhist, though I accept the Buddha's teaching, which comes to me from the East. As a Westerner, I do not feel as much at home with Eastern Buddhist culture, whether Sinhalese, Thai, or Tibetan, as one brought up within it. Moreover, although there is Western Buddhism, in the sense that there are tens of thousands of Europeans and Americans who regard themselves as Buddhists, there is no such thing as a Western Buddhist culture. I can therefore well understand the feelings of the English academic who, having converted back to Catholicism after 25 years as a member of a Tibetan Buddhist group, was delighted to find himself surrounded in his native land by the cathedrals, pilgrimage sites, and other holy places of his religion. As a Western Buddhist, I am not so similarly situated. The English landscape is not dotted with stupas and many walls and other reminders of the Dharma. My practice of the Dharma does not have the support of an indigenous Buddhist culture. But things will change. I am confident that the next 100 years will see the beginnings of an indigenous Western Buddhist culture. A few green shoots have already appeared here and there. But even when we have our own Western Buddhist culture, many Western Buddhists will continue to enjoy the poetry, music and art of the old Christian culture. Meanwhile, now that I have finished recalling and reflecting upon my personal contact with Christianity and Christians, I cannot but feel that it is infinitely better for me to be a Western Buddhist without a culture of his own than a Christian with one. The end of From Genesis to the Diamond Sutra by Sangharakshita, read by Subhadra.